What I will do is call a case, and we'll just get started. This is cause number 0320-0088-CV, Barbara Burgess versus Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company. Asking for announcements, please, for appellant Barbara Burgess.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Josh Fogelman for appellant Barbara Burgess.
Thank you. And for appellee?
Good morning. Sarah Allen on behalf of appellee Allstate.
Good morning.
With Mr. Mike Robbins as well, my partner.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to make sure that you have given your time distributions to the clerk of the court. I don't keep time, but he will. And we don't have the little yellow, red, and green light system, so he'll let you know. Yellow paper looks like 2 minutes. Red paper means stop. If you get to the red paper and it says stop, please feel free to finish your argument on that point, but don't proceed further without asking for leave of court. Mr. Fogelman, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I assume we're using the podium today.
Yes, sir.
Great.
I assume so, too.
It's the only light that's lit, so. All right. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Josh Fogelman. I'm here actually along with my co-counsel, Justin Hill, and together we represent Barbara Burgess, the appellant in this matter. I'd like to give the court a brief background, if the court wishes, on the factual and procedural history of the case. Your Honors, this is a basic car wreck case involving uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage, which I'll refer to as UIM throughout this argument. Ms. Burgess was involved in a car wreck in 2014. The driver that hit her had a $100,000 liability policy, and at the time of the collision, Ms. Burgess had a $50,000 UIM policy issued through Allstate. Ms. Burgess went through pretty extensive medical treatment. She sustained an injury to her cervical spine and was recommended for cervical spine surgery. And in response to the severity of the injuries, the at-fault driver's insurance carrier paid their policy limits, the $100,000 policy limits, leaving Ms. Burgess to then pursue a claim on her UIM policy. Ms. Burgess submitted a demand for UIM benefits, which was initially outright rejected by Allstate and was later amended to offer $500 on the $50,000 UIM policy, leaving Ms. Burgess no choice but to initiate a direct action as authorized by the Texas Supreme Court to establish her legal entitlement to UIM benefits at trial, which, if this court is not familiar, to establish your legal entitlement to UIM benefits, you effectively have to try the underlying car wreck case and prove fault and damages, though the insurance company is the named defendant, and it's traditionally done as a declaratory judgment action.
Let me just jump right in, Mr. Fogelman. Did I say that right? Fogelman, yes. So in the context of severance and abatement,
yes,
this court and other courts have recognized that an insurer generally cannot be liable on bad faith claims arising from its denial or failure to investigate a UIM claim that it has no duty to pay. Would you agree that that's correct?
I would agree that that is correct, yes.
So how does that impact your position in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. So there's two reasons. First, if UIM insurers did not have a bad faith or an extra contractual duty to pay benefits, then there would be nothing to sever and abate in the first place. So if you look at the entire history of Texas jurisprudence, including this case, which was basically a seminal opinion in In Re American National Insurance Company, 2012, severance and abatement is done in the context of UIM routinely throughout this state, because the law is very clear that if the UIM insured fails to establish their coverage right under the policy, then their ability to then pursue bad faith claims is mooted. So it's just a procedural mechanism rather than a comment upon the insured's merits to assert a claim for bad faith. Additionally, it's critically important, and this is a major distinction about why the Brainerd case, as Allstate will argue, does not really apply to bad faith claims, is when you're talking about the legal entitlement fight, That's a fight to establish what the insured's rights are under the UIM contract. The Texas Insurance Code mandates that insurance policies contain this very specific language to provide UIM coverage, and throughout the years, the courts have interpreted procedurally what the insured, by the terms of the contract, has to go through in order to establish their technical contractual right to payment. However, even as recently as 2018 in the USAA v. Menchaca case, Texas courts are unanimous that those contractual rights are completely separate and independent from extra contractual duties that are created by the nature of the relationship between an insured and an insurance company. They have this disparity of bargaining power, and so these extra contractual tort duties that create a whole new set of substantive law and create a whole new set of duties kicks in when an insurance company begins the process of handling a claim. And so even though it's confusing, because in order to have a contractual obligation to pay a UIM claim, we're asking that the obligation to pay that claim might have arisen beforehand upon presentation of a demand that a reasonable insurer would have accepted and recognized that coverage was clear. That is something that the courts have dealt with procedurally by requiring first the contractual establishment of legal entitlement to benefits, and then second, if you're successful on that, that causes a ripening of the actual right to bring the claim for bad faith.
But how can an insurance company act in bad faith to settle a claim that at that point they don't have a contractual duty to pay?
That's a great question, Your Honor. It's because they have an extra contractual tort duty to pay that was created by the Texas Supreme Court in a procedurally identical case to this, which was the Arnold case in 1987. And if you review Arnold and the cases that follow Arnold, including Universe Life Insurance Company versus Giles, what they say is, well, even if the contract by its very terms don't mandate payment at that point in time before the legal entitlement has been established, the common law imposes a duty that the adjusters handle the claim with reasonable prudence. So it's effectively imposing a Stowers obligation, and in fact, the Texas Supreme Court recognized this in the Rocor case, that there is effectively a Stowers duty that exists above and beyond the express terms of the contract, that when an insurer is provided with a claim and a demand, and the information in that demand is such that a reasonably prudent insurer would recognize that they are likely liable to pay that claim, they have a duty to pay that claim. And if they fail to pay that claim, and this is out of the Vail case, which is a Texas Supreme Court case as well, if they fail to pay that case, the injury occurs at that time. When a reasonably prudent insurer would have paid that claim, their delay or denial in the payment of in that claim causes a legal damage at that time in at least the amount of the policy benefits withheld, in addition to other actual damages, such as damages for mental anguish or things like loss of credit reputation.
And in this case, mental anguish is really the only other, Ms. Burgess's only other claim, right?
Well, Your Honor, the answer to that question is no. However, Ms. Burgess has asserted a claim for mental anguish damages, and she does assert that Allstate's bad faith conduct in the handling of this claim did cause her mental anguish. Another proposal, although it's probably not ripe for this court's determination at this time, but something that's currently unanswered in Texas law right now, and what we would assert, we don't need to get this in order to have a remand, okay? But what we would assert is that in accordance with the language in Vail, Ms. Burgess, by not getting paid the policy benefits that a reasonably prudent insurer would have paid her upon her...
The $50,000.
Yes, Your Honor, the $50,000. Upon her demand of that, that loss of policy benefits or deprivation of policy benefits was itself an actual damage. And it's not that Ms. Burgess is seeking a double payment. Okay, Allstate paid after we established our legal entitlement. We're not seeking a double recovery here. However, based on the strong public policy that gave rise to these duties to begin with, which I'm glad to go in depth with this court about, it is our position that insurance companies like Allstate have to have some reason not to drag their insureds through a full-blown jury trial.
Can I ask, kind of along that lines, we've got In re Farmers, we've got the In re American National, both out of the Third Court of Appeals, both of which talk about that the insurer doesn't need to do something before that liability is determined, right? Are we bound by that? Do we have to revisit those holdings en banc if we go down the path that you're talking about, since those decisions are already out there and they seem to kind of implicate what we're talking about here? So that's one part of my question. The second part of my question is reliance on In re Farmers and In re American National, is that good faith? Can they make a good faith reliance upon that case law that says, hey, we get to wait or have to wait or get to wait, whatever it is, for this liability determination?
Thank you, Your Honor. In answer to your question, the first question, no, the court does not have to revisit In re American National. In fact, it is crystal clear in case law that the procedure that In re American National set forth is correct. Why that's reconcilable with what we're asking for is In re American National just simply says, if you sued for both bad faith and legal entitlement, you have to sever the bad faith claims from the legal entitlement case and abate them until you've actually demonstrated your right to policy benefits under the contract. Only then are your bad faith claims ripe. And that's exactly what Ms. Burgess did here, and that's exactly what needs to be done. Because if you don't if you fail to establish your legal entitlement to benefits, that severed and abated case is mooted. Okay, but in this particular set of circumstances, Ms. Burgess did establish her legal entitlement to benefits. And so now she's able to move into phase two of the case directly in conjunction with what the procedure set forth in In re American National argued. I want to get to your second point as well. I can't answer the question, Judge, about whether we can say that Allstate's I would say that Allstate's reliance on In re American National and Farmers does not justify their conduct, because neither of those cases say that there is no extra contractual duty to pay claims when liability became reasonably clear. In fact, in 1987, the Texas Supreme Court created that common law duty of good faith and fair dealing specifically applicable to UIM carriers, just like Allstate, in almost a procedurally identical case. So there's just no question. And then that was later codified in Chapter 541 of the Texas Insurance Code. So any insurer who was familiar with the law should be able to just say, hey, someone presented an insured who was hurt and has a bunch of medical bills, presented us with a claim. This claim appears valid. A reasonably prudent insurance carrier would pay. The liability carrier, if they had been stourized, would pay. But we're going to rely on this weird technicality quagmire created by Brainerd and just force our insureds to have to try the case against us. And there's no penalty to us. We got nothing to lose, because the worst thing we'll ever have to pay is our policy benefits. That's just not a reasonable approach.
Isn't that the distinction that the litigants try to make between, say, In re Farmers, where there was no offer of settlement, versus In re American National, where there was an offer of settlement?
Not really, Your Honor. The offer of settlement actually really only the offer of settlement really only comes into play with procedurally whether or not the bad faith cases have to be severed and abated. And the concept there is, if Allstate brings an offer of $500 to the table and we don't sever and abate the legal entitlement case and the bad faith case, we're just trying it all together at the same time, Allstate's going to want to defend itself by saying, we made an offer of settlement. We didn't act in bad faith. But at the same time, the jury might look at that offer and say, oh, well, Allstate made an offer, so therefore they're admitting sort of implicitly that it's a policy limits case. So that's why we sever and abate the bad faith cases, to prevent that from being prejudicial. If there's no offer, then there's a good question about whether severance and abatement is mandatory, but I think the law is clear.
We mandamused conditionally in In re Farmers on that very issue and distinguished between settlement and non-settlement.
Yeah. Yes.
And are we bound by that then?
I don't think you're bound by that. I think procedurally severance is important because failure to establish legal entitlement in phase one moots bad faith in phase two. So that's good law. That's procedurally how it should be. And in fact, the Supreme Court just came down in In re State Farm 2021 Westlaw 1045651 in a case that seems to actually...
Could you repeat that? Sorry.
Yes. 2021 Westlaw 1045651. I've submitted a briefing on this recently. That case was interesting, and it seems to implicitly shut the door on this argument and accept appellant's position, because in that case, rather than file a declaratory judgment action that gets severed and a bad faith action that got severed and abated, the plaintiffs just sued for violations of Chapter 541. And the Texas Supreme Court looked at that and said, well, yeah, this is okay. You can actually go ahead and sue your UIM carrier for bad faith directly through Chapter 541, but what we're going to make you do in accordance, what we're going to do in accordance with In re American County Mutual and all of the other cases that establish the procedural background, we're going to make you bifurcate. So phase one will be legal entitlement and phase two will be bad faith, but all of that can be brought under the umbrella of a direct bad faith cause of action. So why would the Texas Supreme Court not have just dismissed that case for want of jurisdiction when that issue was actually briefed before the court, instead of allowing that case to proceed? So, Your Honor, for these reasons, it is our opinion that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment, and Ms. Burgess should be entitled to proceed with phase two of her cases. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Again, my name is Sarah Allen on behalf of Appalee Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company. I believe it is prudent and helpful for the court to focus on the facts of this specific case, the undisputed summary judgment evidence that was before the trial court at the time of the order that is at issue in this appeal, because what we're really talking about is there any evidence to demonstrate that the trial court erred in this case, as opposed to larger conversation about public policy and the state of the insurance code and the cases before dealing with a number of different issues that are interrelated on the subject.
But didn't Allstate argue, excuse me, at the summary judgment hearing that as a matter of law, these types of claims cannot go forward? I mean, did they?
We argued, respectfully, Your Honor, we argued that based on the evidence in this case, these claims could not go forward. And the argument presented both at the summary judgment hearings briefing and at this court is essentially consistent with the opinion that just came down in the In re State Farm case that Mr. Fogelman referred to. Because what we're really dealing with is we have to come at this from an angle of damages, not just what claims are out there. There's, you know, statutory claims exist, but an essential element, as well as the common law, an essential element of all those claims is legally recoverable damages. And the case law that has come down, including Brainerd, Menchaca, and now this most recent Supreme Court case in In re State Farm from March of this year, indicate that in order for an insured to pursue damages for extra contractual claims, be they statutory or common law, because we know from a number of cases that the standard for the bad faith claims under statutory and common law remain the same. In order to do that, Menchaca tells us you have to do, there are two paths. And the State Farm case really clearly lays out what Menchaca was saying. A lot of attorneys debated whether or not Menchaca clarified anything, depending on what position you were in. But the most recent pronunciation from the Supreme Court earlier this year says there are two paths. One is that you must establish your entitlement to benefits under the policy, which is the first part of the cases we've been discussing. But that's 1A. 1B says you can then pursue those benefits as damages if the insurance carrier's conduct caused you to lose those benefits. Lose is the important word that is used in Menchaca and again in State Farm. There's no loss of benefits here. It is undisputed that Ms. Burgess received every penny of her policy benefits timely after the entry of judgment. So pathway number one is foreclosed under the undisputed facts of this case. Pathway two is an independent injury. We discussed, you asked some questions about the independent injury earlier. What the evidence before the trial court was at the time of the summary judgment hearing was not just the petition, but also plaintiff's disclosures. And in plaintiff's disclosures, she described her damages as policy benefits wrongfully delayed plus attorney's fees. So the disclosures were before the court. That is evidence, competent summary judgment evidence under 166A, discovery responses, and would appear that Ms. Burgess had disclaimed her claim for mental anguish. So that's one reason I don't believe she's been able to successfully assert and claim for independent injury in this case.
Well, what about the attorney's fees? I mean, Mr. Fogelman, I think, alluded to this but didn't say it directly, is, you know, the claim that if she's got to have a full-blown jury trial just to get these, you know, the $50,000 that she's arguing she was entitled to at day one, but she had to spend $20,000 in attorney's fees to get there, how is that not a damage that could be, that somebody could seek under, you know, bad faith and fair dealing for a UIM claim?
Yes, and I believe that when the Texas Supreme Court in Menchaca discusses what an independent injury is, they discuss it as it must be a truly independent injury separate and apart from the recovery of benefits. And the court has ruled that in damages that flow or stem from an insured's right to receive policy benefits are not truly independent. I do not have a case site saying under Menchaca, attorney's fees are not truly independent, but I do know that in the In Re State Farm case, the claims asserted were for, and I actually can, pardon me, I have to put on my readers, I'm afraid.
No worries. And you're talking about the In Re State Farm from March.
Yes, and this is, if you would like that citation again, Mr. Fogelman provided it, but I'd be happy.
No, I don't need it. I've got it.
Okay, very good. They emphasized the plaintiffs in that case, and there were two cases that had been consolidated for the purpose of appeal. The quote from Menchaca that they rely on is that when an insured seeks to recover damages that are predicated on, flow from, or stem from policy benefits, the general rule applies and precludes recovery unless the policy entitles the insured to those benefits. The second part of that is that then the carrier's conduct caused the insured to lose those benefits. But the claims that were being sought in that case, and it's an interesting case, actually. These plaintiffs sued initially for insurance code violations without establishing their right. They didn't do the first phase. They skipped to the second phase. And so the Texas Supreme Court said, in order for us to decide whether or not these claims can, you know, there was an error in failing to bifurcate, we have to look at what the claims are and how they can be pursued. They said that the plaintiffs were seeking their recovery of benefits that they believe they were owed, plus attorney's fees. And the Supreme Court, they talked about the benefits owed, they didn't specifically talk about attorney's fees, but the implied ruling is that the attorney's fees for pursuing your legal the contractual obligation to legally establish your right to benefits is not an independent injury. Nor were the policy benefits themselves. It's
so
not
they
an
don't stem from policy benefits.
Pardon me?
So you're saying that they don't stem from policy benefits, attorney's fees?
I believe the attorney's fees expended in pursuing your right to receive benefits under the policy are not an independent injury from obtaining your rights under the policy. And that is an implied ruling, I believe, that comes from the Emory State Farm case. The second part of it, they said, is that, you know, the policy benefits that you're seeking, and they were seeking attorney's fees as well, They said, that is not an independent injury. You cannot pursue your insurance claims at this point because you haven't asserted a legally recoverable independent injury. And you also haven't established your entitlement to benefits, so the case has to go back for the next step. Making any further ruling would have made it an advisory opinion because the plaintiffs in that case had not yet established their right to benefits.
But taking a step back in Ray State Farm, you know, the court says a plaintiff who succeeds in the first phase of the case may then proceed to litigate its insurance code claims in light of the result of the initial trial. So would you agree, is this a recognition that extra contractual claims may arise from settlement that happened before the liability termination?
Well, I under the current state of the law, if there's no loss of policy benefits, Menchaca says you can't receive policy benefits as for a violation, a statutory and or common law violation, since the standards remain the same. So if there's no loss, and in this case it is undisputed that there was no loss of benefits, then that first path, I believe, is foreclosed entirely, which leads to the second path. And in this case, the issue with the independent injury that I see is that in her statement, in her discovery responses, and which was before the trial court at the time of summary judgment, appears to have disclaimed the claim for mental anguish because it's not included in her amount and calculation of economic damages. But there is also, I believe, a second point that precludes the claim of mental anguish in this case from being considered an independent injury. And that is, mental anguish was submitted to the jury in the underlying case as a request for policy benefits. The claim for mental anguish presented in the underlying case demonstrates that Ms. Burgess was pursuing mental anguish damages as policy benefits. And so those would not be truly independent of her right to receive benefits.
But are those two different mental anguish allegations? I mean, is it one mental anguish allegation based on the insurance company not investigating her insured motorist claim versus mental anguish associated with the accident and the treatment and all these other portions? Or is it your belief, no, it's all just wrapped up in one?
You know, I mean, it is possible. It is possible that that could be the case, that there could be separate claims. However, in this case, based on the evidence before the court at the time of summary judgment, and again, the decision is, did the trial court err? And based on the disclosure responses that did not include mental anguish damages, I don't believe there was an error.
I have a question.
I apologize.
Yeah. How could a jury determine mental anguish on the loss, the delay on the UIM, if the only thing that they were determining because of a proper severance, yes, there was a proper severance here, yeah? The only thing they were determining was the original liability. How could they even reach that question?
Well, and actually procedurally in this case, they were two separate lawsuits. The extra contractual claims were non-suited. They weren't a part of the lawsuit, but it's the same as severance.
That's what I'm saying. So they weren't a part of that proceeding. So how could the jury reach those mental anguish issues if it wasn't before them?
Well, it is simply that Ms. Burgess has made the statement that she was pursuing mental anguish damages as policy benefits. I understand your point. It is entirely possible, I believe, I haven't seen it, that there could be an articulation of mental anguish that says, I attribute all of this mental anguish to this one thing, but then I have this other mental anguish during the same time period attributable to something else. I just don't believe that that's what has been presented. That was not what was before the trial court at the time of the summary judgment hearing.
Competing summary judgments.
Yes, ma'am.
But I want to take a step back kind of on big picture and a lot of the things that you talked about in your brief. But would you agree that under Boyd, you can't bring a bad faith and fair dealing claim based on UIM after trial?
I believe that the conduct after the entry of judgment would not support that claim. Yes.
Right, because they said the relationship has changed. Your relationship is now of creditor and debtor.
As to the claims that were presented in the underlying case, yes.
Okay. And at least, you know, as discussed in your brief, under your interpretation of Brainerd, you can't bring a bad faith claim before trial.
Well, I believe that those claims, generally speaking, can be asserted, but the courts procedurally have gone through this either severance and abatement or bifurcation process. I don't believe that that means those claims can't be asserted, but I believe that we have to look at it from the point of view of, are there legally recoverable damages asserted for those claims? Because Menchaca, as clarified by the State Farm case that came out in March of this year, tells us the narrow circumstances under which insureds can pursue damages for extra contractual liability when, you know, against their carriers. And so you either have to have a loss of benefits or you have to have an independent injury.
So the only way that they could show bad faith is to not pay the UIM after the liability was established?
Or if they establish or if they establish a legally recoverable independent injury.
Okay, so you're not arguing good faith and fair dealing in the context of UIM has gone away because of Brainerd?
Not at all. It's simply that Arnold doesn't exist in a vacuum. The Texas Supreme Court's rulings regarding UIM and regarding extra contractual liability over the years that have come since then must be taken into account and harmonized in order to be able to reach the conclusion in this case as the trial court did. And the fact that Brainerd tells us no benefits are contractually owed until a judgment is entered or a settlement is reached. That addresses the fact that those benefits are not yet owed. And so if they're not yet owed, refusal to pay them is not a loss or denial of benefits, they're just not owed. Once they are established, if they're paid, there's no loss of benefits. And this is where Menchaca adds an additional gloss, as well as Inzari State Farm adding in another gloss.
Doesn't that create a scenario where if an insurance company arbitrarily denies a claim, then an insured could spend tens of thousands of dollars to obtain the determination that the insurance company, pays what it owes, right? In this case, $50,000. I mean, do you think that's what the court in Brainerd intended, that now every litigant who wants to get their benefits now, even if they're arbitrarily denied, even if the insurance company does nothing, is now forced to spend these tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees in order to get there?
Well, I don't believe that that's necessarily what Brainerd was addressing or dealing with, but I do believe that we cannot ignore that Brainerd exists and that UIM coverage is unique and separate and different than other types of coverage. It is really when you add the Menchaca opinion and then this most recent opinion in Inre State Farm that talk about what damages can be recovered for these types of claims, that all of this comes into focus with regard to the facts in this case. And so it is not necessarily that was what the court was contemplating, but certainly the court was contemplating when an insured can recover extra contractual damages for extra contractual liability in Menchaca. That was the essential issue at play. And the language in Menchaca could not be more clear. There has to be a loss of benefits or an independent injury. And those are the two issues, I believe, that were presented and argued before the trial court, and the trial court had sufficient evidence before it to determine that the claims, Ms. Burgess's claims, could not go forward.
How would you define reasonably clear in the UIM-UM context after Brainerd and Arnold and
I appreciate the question. I really do. And I would love for my authority, the voice of my opinions to really carry weight. I believe that there were some cases that discussed there's a line of federal cases. And I hesitate to discuss them because they kind of went back and forth, and I understand that, and I'm not trying to hide from any of that, although none of the federal law would take precedent over the Texas Supreme Court's decisions in this case. But one of the cases found that, you know, the trial of the UIM claim is what makes the liability reasonably clear, the outcome of the trial. Now, that has not been adopted as the hard and fast standard in the state of Texas, so I couldn't say if it would be. I'm not sure. What I do understand is that really when we're looking at it from a perspective of what damages can be recovered, because damages are an essential element. If we knock out damages, you can't go forward. And we were on summary judgment, and that's really kind of what we focused our briefing on before the trial court as well as this court. I'm afraid I don't have a ready-made answer, but I do understand that that is an issue that I don't know if the Texas Supreme Court has going to revisit any of its opinions. I don't believe that any of the arguments that we've made have been inconsistent with the series of cases leading up to where we are now. And I believe that those cases indicate that as of the state of the law in Texas at the time the summary judgment was granted, the trial court did not err in granting summary judgment because there was no loss of benefits and there was no independent injury.
But if the standard, if reasonably clear means you've already had a trial and, you know, there's already been a determination of liability, I mean, isn't that the same as saying conclusively proved as a matter of law? Reasonably clear equals conclusively proved as a matter of law? I guess I'm wondering, is there any room in between?
I imagine it's possible. I just don't believe that that's what the Supreme Court has said about whether or not these claims can go forward. It's, you know, if any of these issues do end up before them, it is entirely possible that they may have to go back and look at some of the precedent, but to say whether or not they believe, you know, these cases do or do not apply. But the fact is, this is the current state of the law. And without the loss of benefits, then the claims can't go forward without a recoverable independent injury. But I understand the distinction you're making, and I think that is something that that perhaps is an unanswered question, but it doesn't make, I don't believe, the summary judgment in this case improper or in error.
Let me ask you another question about, because there's a split of authority right now out there on this. Is that a fair statement?
Yes and no. I'd love to address that issue if you would like, Your Honor.
Because I hear you saying the Supreme Court, and so regardless of what we've said or some of the other intermediate appellate courts, I don't hear that you're too concerned about a split of authority or us going down an uncharted path.
Right, and I believe the reason that is that in going back and reviewing the potential split that existed, first, we had Bryant, which was the case that came out of the Court of Appeals in Dallas. In Dallas, they said, you cannot, when there's no loss of benefits and no independent injury, you cannot pursue these claims. Then we had Cook come out of San Antonio Court of Appeals. They said, we believe these claims should at least be able to go forward. It was a permissive appeal after the denial of summary judgment, but the court, you know, they sent it up. And the San Antonio Court of Appeals said, we believe these could go forward. We make no finding on whether or not these claims are legitimate. We just believe they can go forward. Your Honor. Then we had the Fort Worth Court of Appeals in another In Re State Farm, not to be confused with the Texas Supreme Court case, as that one came out of Dallas, not Fort Worth. And in that case, it was a mandamus on a discovery issue, and they went through and tried, you know, to deal with harmonizing Brainerd and Arnold. In Cook, the San Antonio case, and in In Re State Farm, the Fort Worth case, neither one of those courts discussed Menchaca once. They didn't address whether or not these claims could be pursued under the framework that Menchaca presents. Now, it is perhaps because they didn't believe Menchaca is a homeowner's case. Perhaps they didn't think that Menchaca applied to UIM. But we now know, as of March of this year, that the Texas Supreme Court in the In Re State Farm case has told us yes, Menchaca's framework applies to UIM claims. So I don't believe that there's necessarily a split. I think there are parts missing from the Fort Worth and San Antonio opinions where they failed to address those arguments. Perhaps they weren't presented. Perhaps they weren't ripe. However, they did not address the impact that Menchaca has. And so now that we see that Menchaca does apply to UIM claims, I believe that reconciles in a way the case law. So you have to look at the specific facts, the specific damages in a specific case in order to determine whether or not claims can go forward after a summary judgment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Fulham?
I apologize. I got stuck. Oh, there's a lip.
We ready? Thank you, judges. At the outset, I would like to address a mischaracterization of the procedural history of this case. When this MSJ was before the judge, we were at the infancy of discovery. There was not an argument made in any briefing that Ms. Burgess had failed to present evidence of a mental anguish case. This was not a no evidence motion for summary judgment. This was clearly and squarely a traditional motion for summary judgment on whether or not Brainerd should be extended to abrogate common law and statutory causes of action of good faith and fair dealing related to pre-legal entitlement conduct by insureds. Looking at discovery responses is going to yield no benefit to this court in as relates to how the procedural posture of this case is. Mental anguish damages would not be disclosed and identified specifically in response to RFDs because they are not economic damages. And Justice Kelly and Justice Goodwin, y'all hit the nail right on the head when you suggested that mental anguish damages sought in a bad faith claim can be separate and independent from the mental anguish damages that the jury heard evidence of in the legal entitlement claim. Those are caused by two separate and independent torts. That is clear and unequivocal through 30 years of Texas Supreme Court precedent, beginning with the Arnold case. So I would like to make that clear. I would also like to point out that at no point in any briefing did Allstate state that because we hadn't put on any evidence of mental anguish damages, the only damages we could seek were policy benefits. That is not the issue here. We have alleged both actual damages in the form of mental anguish damages and actual damages in the form of loss of policy benefits in accordance with Vail's language that if you deny payment of benefits under a policy, the loss of those benefits occurs at that time when they were unlawfully denied.
But when you're reading the motion, the order on the motion for summary judgment, it's fairly general. So if there's any, you know, given our standard of review,
Understood, Judge. Look at the pleadings. We pled mental anguish damages. We pled actual damages. Discovery is irrelevant here. The discovery period had not ended, and we would not have identified and calculated mental anguish damages in response to our discovery anyways. That's not what you do, because mental anguish are non-economic damages, not economic damages.
Thank you.
Okay. Justice Kelly, to clarify your point on the Boyd case, Boyd focused exclusively on the conduct of the UIM insurer after the UIM insured had established their legal entitlement to benefits, okay? They went through, got their legal entitlement to benefits, got a judgment, and then the UIM carrier engaged in some additional conduct. And the Texas Supreme Court said, because the insured had established a legal entitlement to benefits and was now a judgment creditor, they had a bunch of enforcement mechanisms available to them that they could utilize to get money from the UIM insured and UIM insurer. Those mechanisms that they did not have available during the handling and claims process. And it is the availability of those remedies that changed the nature of their relationship and removed the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which is interesting because the Boyd case actually states that the duty of good faith and fair dealing terminates when the judgment has occurred, which implies that the duty of good faith and fair dealing existed before the legal entitlement was obtained. And I would like this court to take specific notice that in light of that, despite what Allstate just represented to this court, they are definitely arguing that UIM insurers owe zero statutory or common law duties of good faith and fair dealings in the handling of any and all UIM claims in Texas. They are saying that it is the trial of the legal entitlement that is the investigation, despite legislative mandate that they investigate. And they are arguing that it could never have been reasonably clear that they should have paid Ms. Burgess policy limits until that legal entitlement verdict was taken, despite the fact that third-party liability carriers are charged with making those types of discretionary decisions all the time under the Stowers Doctrine, and first-party carriers are also charged with making those decisions all the time under ROCOR and its progeny. And if this court is going to extend Brainerd's logic, which only applied to contractual duties, and envelop all of the 30 years of statutory and extra-contractual common law duties, and overrule the Arnold case, which gave rise to these duties to begin with, we would have expected that Brainerd would have mentioned those cases, or mentioned the bad faith insurance statute, but it didn't. It did not, and this court should not extend that case so far. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Fogelman. Thank you, Ms. Allen, for a compelling argument. With that, the case will be submitted and the court is adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.